Docket number 88252, Allen v. State. Counsel, will you come on up? Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, Mr. Goodman, you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, would you like to reserve any time?
I'd like to reserve three minutes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Ross Goodman on behalf of Appellant's Counsel, and may it please the Court. The crux of this appeal is that the District Court improperly prevented Michael Allen, the appellant, from presenting to a jury relevant and material evidence of an alternate suspect. As this Court knows, the facts of the case are that appellant's son, who was 21 years of age at the time, was adjudicated guilty of a sex offense against a sibling who was living in the house at the time. The District Court, in a minute order, without relying on any case authority, statutes, or analysis, issued a one-minute order claiming that there was nothing relevant in the juvenile records of Alex Skorkinski, who is the 21-year-old who was residing in the house, who had the sex offense against a sibling. By excluding Alex's prior sex conviction, the District Court denied the appellant the right to present his theory of defense. The state relies on two cases for its assertion that the District Court properly refused to admit evidence of Alex Skorkinski's prior sex offense against a sibling. And both of those cases actually support the fact that a prior sex offense of somebody else living in the house against a sibling would be relevant and material for presentation for an alternate suspect defense. They cited Davis v. Alaska, which I replied to at length in the reply, where that involved the almost exact same issue that you have here in this case, where you had a juvenile, Richard Green, who was a crucial witness for the prosecution. Prosecution had been granted a protective order to prevent cross-examination into Richard Green's juvenile criminal record, claiming that it was not relevant and probative as to whether or not he was an alternate suspect. The United States Supreme Court said that Green acted out of fear or concern of possible jeopardy to his probation. Not only might Green have made a hasty and faulty identification of petitioner to shift suspicion away from himself as one who robbed the Polar Bar, but Green might have been subject to undue pressure from the police and made his identification under fear of possible probation revocation. Even more, Green's record would be revealed only as necessary to probe Green for bias and prejudice and not generally to call good character into question. Here, you have a more compelling reason. You have a juvenile record, and the policy for sealing and preventing a juvenile record from being disclosed is to protect the juvenile's history. However, that gives way to a constitutional right of cross-examination and the right of confrontation as it relates to the alternate suspect defense.
A
couple things, because I want to distinguish between the use of a juvenile adjudication to impeach and simply the ability to impeach Alex with the prior conduct under that. So I want to, if you can tell me, is that a distinction without a difference or not? because it didn't rely, the father or the defendant in this instance was aware of Alex's conduct.
Right, Your Honor, I think...
was prohibited, I understand, from asking Alex any questions regarding that contact, separate and apart from the juvenile adjudication.
So I think it goes specifically to his right to confront, Alex and present a coherent and material defense claiming that he's the alternate suspect. Alex is the true assailant of this crime. So how does the defense present a complete defense theory while you're handcuffed and shackled by propping up Alex, as the state did, to say that he's this nice guy without the ability to let the jury make an informed decision and know that he has a sex offense against a sibling, not just a general sex offense, but one against a sibling. And we know that to be prevalent in the jury's minds because they asked a litany of questions, which I outlined in both the opening brief and the reply, where the jury was asking whether or not Alex had a criminal record, whether or not his whereabouts for that day, whether or not he was right or left-handed, whether or not the cameras would have shown the back door, just the front door. So the jury was keen on the fact that there was some passing reference that Alex was the alternate suspect, but yet they weren't provided the evidence, the critical evidence, so that they can make an informed decision on whether or not Alex was a true assailant. I don't know if that answered your question fully. But,
in what ways are you suggesting that the state bolstered his character or said he was a nice guy?
The state knew because of the pretrial motion that the defense could not introduce evidence that Alex Skikorsky had a prior sex offense against a sibling. So in rebuttal, which was improper but not a topic of issue for this appeal, is that they then propped Alex up to have him testify on how he felt with his sister, and he testified he was distraught and he was upset about what happened, and that to imply a negative inference, to say, okay, Alex is such a good guy. He cared. He was distraught. He was upset. He was caring for his sister. There's no way that this individual that the defense is allowed to say in passing is an alternate suspect could be an alternate suspect because of his relationship and his demeanor after the crime.
So how exactly is the fact that Alex did something when he was 13 relevant in the context of this case? Because it would seem that there's three possibilities from the defense standpoint, that either the child was lying and so nothing occurred, right? In which case, whatever Alex may have done in the past is not relevant. Or number two, it's an identity case, meaning she misidentified Alan as Alex, which again, doesn't have anything to do with anything Alex may have done in the past. Or number three, she's fabricating. It was actually Alex and she's lying and saying it was Alan, which again would seem to not really implicate anything that Alex did in his past. So we can't just go from Alex had a prior sex offense to therefore it would have been helpful and admissible. I get that it would have been helpful, but how does it become relevant and how does its value not get outweighed by the danger of what a jury would think about just hearing that this kid did something when he was 13.
When you take the evidence in this case in its totality, you have this victim, Amalia, I'll just refer to her, admitting to Michael Allen's niece that the jury heard Alex did it. Right. You have if her version of events were true, you would have DNA evidence. And as the court could see, the DNA evidence was all inconclusive. In fact, there was no male DNA on the breast and upper neck area, the upper underwear. It was conclusive for the a vaginal swab, and for the monas a pubis, it was a slight amount of DNA that was male DNA that they said was a female profile. So now think about arguing to a jury in closing argument, the state in rebuttal saying there's DNA male DNA, but it was such a small amount, and they never heard that Alex, another male in the household, had a prior conviction for the exact same offense. And so that would be relevant and material given the context of this case. There's no forensic evidence of any kind, Your Honor. There was where she admitted it was Alex was a perpetrator, and you have somebody, and you know, Alex just so happens to have a previous adjudication for a sex offense, again, against a sibling. I think that's what makes this an injustice, because I believe that that in order to answer a question a different way, it's not so much about the three different options, Your Honor, as it is, does the appellant have a constitutional right to present a complete defense so the jury can make that decision? Because they were already concerned without hearing about his criminal record with the number of questions that they admitted to or submitted to the district court judge, whether or not he had a criminal record and whether or not he was there during those hours. So obviously, they thought it was relevant. This does not go towards the general credibility. This is not one of many issues that the state presented in their answering brief. The rape shield law does not apply to this case. That has to do directly with the victim. Obviously, Alex is a third party. 48.045 does not apply in this case. This is relevant evidence. What's the basic definition, statutory definition of relevance? Would it make something more probable? The fact that you have an individual in the household who has access to this victim who was previously adjudicated of a sex crime against a sibling, would that be more probable for a jury's determination on whether or not he committed this sex offense as well? That's up for a jury, but Michael Allen should have been able to have the ability to present that for the jury's consideration. With that, I'll reserve my time.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Sam Kern on behalf of Respondent State of Nevada. The issues presented here, and there are three, are basically the district court order, the sufficiency of the evidence in the case, and cumulative error. I'll start with the district court order. That seems to be the most interesting issue presented. And so I'd submit that appellant's argument, the issues are actually much more narrow than he argues. His claim that the district court improperly determined that the juvenile justice records related to Alexander Sikorsky were relevant is an unsubstantiated claim here. We've got the district court's determination that 17 pages of juvenile justice records from a 2010 case involving non-parties to the trial case were irrelevant. That's all that the district court ordered. That's a very limited order, and it was done, I think, a year before trial in 2022. There's no indication whatsoever that the information contained in those documents would have been relevant to this case, and the mere fact of their existence cannot, therefore, just make them relevant. To hold that the mere existence of juvenile justice records makes them relevant to a trial case would kind of make a in-camera review or the entire process of in-camera review of protected records meaningless, not only for juvenile justice records, but for any sort of privileged record. When the parties agree, as they did here, that the district court should make that determination, and that was done through the stipulation of the parties in front of the district court, then it can't be built in error because one party is then unhappy with the district court's determination as to the relevance of those records. I think it's also important to keep in mind, as we're looking at this, that appellant was able to provide the district court with whatever information he thought was necessary for the district court to make that decision. And at the time that the district court made the decision, the information in the record did not indicate that appellant had a witness that was going to come forward and claim that the victim in this case, had told her that it was Alex. The information that the court had available to it was the defendant's statement and defendant's submittal within the stipulation and order that there was another male living in the house. That's the information the defendant chose to provide the court. And the court also indicated within its minute order that it had reviewed the papers and pleas on file. And so I think we can safely read that the court had also reviewed the declaration of arrest that would have been part of the bindover packet that was submitted to the court. And so within that declaration of arrest, there's also no indication that there was going to be a cousin coming in claiming, you know, 5 years after the fact that...
Counsel, I want to just stop you for a second. You don't need the cousin. Alex is going to testify. And the court before the trial, as I understood the record, instructed the defense, that, and I think at the request of the state, you know, just to remind everybody, we're not going into any of that, that they could not ask Alex, who was going to be a witness, about the conduct or about anything about that. So that's a little different than saying the court's not giving out the records. That is the court also denying an area of inquiry that's potentially relevant.
And so I believe that that statement came up at the beginning of the trial. Ms. Marlin had kind of brought it in front of, to the court's attention that her understanding of the state of the evidence at the time was that that information was not going to come in. And so her stated reasoning for that information not coming in, I think, was mistaken. Her position as to the state of evidence was, in fact, correct. That evidence at that point in time was not something that defense could have gotten into.
But why? Why couldn't you say the defendant had a good faith belief in that having happened such to be able to ask about it? And then as a second question, how can this court say 48045 subsection 2 applies to witnesses, but 48045 subsection 3 doesn't?
So part of defendant's argument is kind of this asking the court to imagine these hypothetical scenarios in which he would have then moved the court in order to admit this evidence. And each one of these hypotheticals, though, I think, you know, first of all, he didn't make those motions. He didn't move the court to admit this evidence under any subsection of NRS 48045. He didn't move to ask the court to admit it as impeachment evidence. And so we're kind of in this realm of like, what if? What if he had done that? And so I think, first of all, because he didn't make those motions, he's waived those claims. But second of all, you know, to the extent that the district court's 2022 determination as to relevance is going to be viewed in light of what could have been, what maybe he would have done, there isn't a scenario in which even a motion to bring those records in would have been successful based on the information that we have in front of us. And so we've got, you know, potentially under NRS 48045, you know, character evidence is not admissible to show that somebody acted in conformity, except for subsection 2, where you bring it in for, you know, intent, motive, identity, lack of mistake, and 3, where the state is able to bring information in relevant to a defendant.
Where does it say, I'm sorry, in subsection 3, where does it say it's only admissible against a defendant and only the state can bring it in against a defendant? And 3 being the propensity.
And I would submit to you that is contained not only within the language that the legislature chose to use in enacting that statute. It uses the term criminal prosecution. Within that same chapter, it uses different language to distinguish when evidence can be brought in by both the prosecution and the defense. The criminal prosecution language is used in subsection 3 of NRS 48045. If you look just a couple sections above that, we've got NRS 48061, and that specifically allows the prosecution and defense to bring in evidence related to domestic violence. The term that they use there is a criminal proceeding. I think there's a distinction between when a criminal prosecution is used by the legislature to define at what point the evidence can be brought in versus when they obviously choose different language to distinguish when both the prosecution and the defense can bring in evidence. They choose the term criminal proceeding. And so that that statute specifically allows both the defense and the prosecution to bring in evidence, and they made the choice to use different language to distinguish between the two. I think it's also common sense that this would be limited to a prosecution case. To hold otherwise would open the door to defense bringing in the sexual offenses of virtually anybody that's involved in or not involved, but anybody in the area.
Well, it would have to be, I mean, counsel still has to be relevant. I mean, we can go back to the court's determination that it wasn't relevant. And something can be relevant and still not admissible, and that's the court exercising its gatekeeping function. Here you have a prior adjudication that contains allegations that are on all fours with the allegations that occurred here. You have a victim who is alleged to have identified the person involved in that adjudication as the perpetrator, at least in some, even if it's in an oblique fashion. So can we really say it's not relevant? Whether or not the court should have admitted it, can we really say it's not relevant at all, or that if a person is defending that situation, that they wouldn't be able to cross-examine on it?
Well, I guess that, you know, is also kind of an open question as to, you know, we don't have any information in the record about the content of those juvenile justice records. And so we're going along this, you know, a potentially they could have filed a motion kind of path here. If they had filed a motion, we would have had a better record as to what they're actually seeking to bring in. Now, to say that, well, the district court precluded them from filing a motion because of this earlier determination, I don't think actually lines up with the sequence of events. Because
but even if we take those documents out, the district court precluded the defense from asking Alex, even though they had a good faith basis to believe that these prior acts had occurred, separate and apart from anything in an adjudicatory file. The defendant was there when these things were happening. He was there when this person was going through the juvenile process. So he has information outside of the folder that's on the judge's desk. Correct. And the court said, you cannot ask about that. So two different sources of that information.
So the court, are you referring then to the trial court or the trial judge's statement about referring to that information?
Yes, when the state said, just to be clear, we're not going into any of that, and the court said, that's right, we're not.
Well, there was actually kind of two parts of that conversation, if I may. So the initial part was Ms. Marland discussing that, you know, her understanding of the state of the evidence at the time was that there was a motion to limine precluding the evidence from being brought in. And she just wanted to make sure that trial counsel Mr. Frizzell was not going to ask any of his witnesses about that. Trial counsel Mr. Frizzell indicated that he had told his witnesses that they were not going into that information. The district court then says something to the effect of, oh, was this Judge Bluth's case at the time? It must have been. Well, if there's a motion to limine, obviously you can't get into that. And I'm paraphrasing broadly here, but so I think when looking at that conversation, the state was under the impression that the information wasn't going to come in. Defense was under the impression the information wasn't going to come in. And the trial court, I don't think, was issuing an order there so much as agreeing with both sides, both parties, that if somebody said that the information isn't coming in, then it's not coming in. However, my point on that is not so much that the reasoning for the information not coming in at that time was stated accurately, but the effect or the actual state of the evidence at the time was that it was not coming in because nobody had filed a motion for that to come in. And so you can't judge,
go ahead. No, but a motion for again, it's at least in my read, I wasn't there.
Of course, yeah.
It is conflating two things to me. One is the conversations with Judge Bluth about the release of information and the information contained within the juvenile file, which is separate from everyone else in the world who knows about that. So if the court's coming forward saying we're not talking about that because nothing was released, I guess there's not much to talk about, or not to talk about an adjudication. But the fact that you can't question Alex about his conduct is where I'm separating those things out. And it seemed clear to me the court, the last kind, and I know it was quick because it was one of those last second things before trial started, then the court, in some instances, broadened that to the extent of you may not ask about that.
And so, again, Your Honor, I think at that, just focusing on that portion of the trial court's discussion about it, essentially what the trial court was doing at that point was saying that, okay, state and defense, you both seem to agree that these things are not coming in. Obviously, if there's been a ruling on that prior to, then they're not coming in. However, my point on that is that at that point in time, that was correct because nobody had filed a motion to bring that information in.
Why would he need a motion to impeach? Why would he need a motion to use information that's within their own purview to impeach the witness?
Impeachment is one of those situations where they can get into that information if it becomes a matter, if it becomes relevant. And so, you know, so now we're outside of NRS 40.045 and subsection 2 and 3, and we're into impeachment. And impeachment is one of those areas where you can bring in external information. And defense says, well, you know, he put Alex on the stand knowing that I couldn't get into this information. I was fully aware when Alex was on the stand that if I asked the wrong question, he's getting into that information, or defense trial counsel is getting into that information. And so I was very careful in asking those questions not to get into that information. That's something that could have happened if I had asked the wrong question. That's something that could have happened if anything that Alex said was in fact impeachable by virtue of his prior sexual offense, which is why I wasn't going to ask any of those questions at all. And so it's not so much that there was not certain scenarios that it could have been breached or that conversation, that the information couldn't have come in, but we never got to any of those scenarios. Defense didn't actually file a motion.
Procedurally, if I'm understanding it, part of the problem is that a judge rules that the records are not going to be disclosed because they're not relevant. Thereafter, nobody makes a motion about excluding or including the conduct itself, correct?
Correct.
Acknowledging Justice Siglich's question about, well, why should somebody have to do that if it's relevant? Even if it wasn't required to be done, it appears that Mr. Frizzell just agreed prior to trial that they didn't think they were supposed to go into it and weren't going into it.
Correct.
Okay. But separate from all of that, there wasn't anything at trial, at least as I understand or what I've read, that prohibited the defense from pointing the finger at Alex, maybe asking Alex directly, did you abuse Aaliyah? Were you at the house that night? Did you go in her room? Are you the one that did this? Or asking any other witnesses about anything related to Alex having committed the act. It was just that nobody went into things that Alex was purported to have done when he was 13 years old.
Exactly right, Your Honor. Justice.
And I'm sorry, I went past the time.
I think I am past time. Any other questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
This court issued an order directing the district court to submit any records of that in-chamber hearing, which none existed. And that's exactly the point. When Judge Bluth should have at a minimum, and I believe to answer my colleague's question about would make in-camera review like eviscerated, is that at least put, it's still confidential, you can still seal the reasoning on why you found it not to be relevant. And so therein lies the issue, because the defense did file a motion for reconsideration, specifically saying that Alex was a perpetrator of a sexual misconduct with a sibling and had access to the alleged victim, and the records were completely irrelevant to the defense. So then Judge Tara Jones basically said, well, I'm not going to get into it. It doesn't appear that Judge Bluth made any error in issuing that one-line minute order, so I'm not even going to reconsider it. And therein lies a record. Without the benefit of having those records, which the defense is entitled to, how do you effectively prepare a theory of an alternate suspect?
But how do you effectively prepare
for cross-examination?
So he was perfectly aware, just as Justice Stiglitz just indicated, he's perfectly aware of what happened.
Sure.
So he's got that information.
Right. I mean, I can't get into Mr. Frizzell's mind, Your Honor. All I can tell you is that to say that the documents are records, because the court's asking, well, you know, to solve this, to remedy it, that Mr. Frizzell should have just said, hey, isn't it true that you, you know, abused Aaliyah? No, I didn't. Now what do you do at that point? You don't have any records. You can't impeach them. I mean, the case probably would have been negotiated had those records been released, because they're relevant. Nobody can sit here today, even a reviewing court, without the record and say that's not relevant, despite the fact that he was 13 years old at the time.
But the same token, you know, it could have been cleared up at that point. We're going to get into this area of inquiry. We're not going to look to submit these records. We're going to get into this area of inquiry.
Well, how would you impeach the witness?
Well,
then?
And if he's impeaching, he's perjuring himself.
And how do you, okay? And how do you effectively?
Everybody knows kind of what's.
But you have a constitutional right to have a complete defense under the right of confrontation. So that's not a complete defense by saying you can in passing ask a witness and take his word for it when there's actual records that would exist that would show the jury was very interested in knowing whether or not he had a criminal record. They were very interested in a lot of things with Alex. I think again, Your Honor, is compounded here. The injustice here versus other cases is that the DNA, there's no DNA. There's the prosecution in rebuttal used every negative inference that they could unfairly. They said, oh, there's male DNA. It doesn't rise to the level of a profile, but that should substantiate and corroborate what she said, because the jury, again, never heard from the fact that, okay, you have another male in the house who also had a similar offense. And so I think given the facts in this case, Your Honor, that the first threshold question is whether or not it's relevant. And how would any reviewing court say that that is not relevant, making a determination more or less probable that he, Alex, is the alternate suspect?
Okay. Colleagues, questions? Okay, thank you for the presentations and
thank
the briefing
you.
In this case. And submit.